Mr. Bill Garson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you ready?
I am indeed.
Okay, come on up. And I just want to confirm, you've taken 13 minutes of your main argument and two of rebuttal?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me, if I could, and I want to get right to the point that is on my mind here, and again, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for my colleagues, Judge Clevenger and Judge Lynn. But you've brought to us an appeal from an inequitable conduct determination.
Correct.
And we all know the law. There has to be a clear and convincing case of materiality and intent, and then there's a balancing. The district court here found materiality based on, I'll call it, five things. Okay? The third and fourth office actions, the preferred engineering literature, the genius literature, and the German patent. Okay? Now, it seems to me that our case law, thinking of DACO and other decisions, is pretty clear that you can't really quarrel with the district court's determination on the office actions in the continuation application. Well, you may quarrel with that, but for my question, the purposes of my question, what would be helpful to me if you could explain as concisely and from your standpoint as effectively as you can why there is clear error in the determination of non-cumulativeness with respect to the preferred engineering literature, the genius literature, and the German patent. I apologize for that long-winded, but I want to frame it, and now go ahead.
Your Honor, I'm delighted. You got it. You understand. But I will say, with respect
to the latter, but
I understand. But okay. With respect to the office actions, we'll have to differ with those, and I will address those. But
just focus, if you could, on those.
I will focus on those references. The first reference was the preferred literature, and this was a reference or a brochure, if you will, that showed a screen that could travel in tracks, had an elongated bar that would travel in tracks, and that's it. That's what it showed. Our position was that the Kemp patent, which was before the patent office, showed that very thing. In fact, Kemp was a little bit different because it added the fact that the bar, which traveled in the tracks, could be attached to glass.
Is the key here issue the bar traveling in the tracks with weather stripping?
In between the weather stripping, that's correct, Your Honor. That's the key. And the reason why, with respect to the preferred, that it was not cumulative is, first, the testimony of the expert was that, at least in part, his opinion was based on the fact that the preferred literature was represented commercial stuff, stuff that was sold. So, therefore, that was an important part of his decision as to why it was material and was not cumulative to the Kemp patent.
You're talking about the Hall testimony?
That's correct, the Hall testimony. That was Luminart's expert. And the other thing with respect to preferred is that the...
Brian, your point with respect to that is that was error for the trial judge to get all, get all worried about this reference because it was commercial. He said it's no more significant or insignificant whether it refers to something that was sold as to a picture of something that wasn't.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And he bought the argument. But there's another reason why that...
I gather what you're trying to do right now in this argument is to convince us that there was not clear and convincing evidence that the preferred literature was non-human.
You are correct, Your Honor.
Because the data points are Kemp, the data points are you can't put the fellow on the scale against non-accumulation because of commerciality. What's the next point?
Then the next point is that this preferred literature was known by Luminart before it filed its request for re-examination.
And you have a case you cited in your brief.
The Sensonics case, Your Honor. And that says that weighs against finding that it's material.
So that's the preferred literature. What about the genius?
The genius literature, again, was this commercial literature. And again, the expert said because it was commercial, that was part of his decision as to why it was not cumulative. But the Genius literature showed a bunch of different screen configurations, including those that were retractable, that had a bar on the free
end. And which art is it came in?
The Kissinger patent.
Kissinger.
And the Kissinger patent shows the very same thing. It has a retractable screen with a bar on the end that extends into...
We've got a lot of issues here. I'm sorry to interrupt
you. Not a problem, Your Honor.
In order for you to succeed on knocking down the materiality because of the fact that you believe it's cumulative, do you have to show that Kissinger shows exactly the same thing as Genius, or do you have to show that there could be some doubt in a reasonable mind?
Well,
standard is not... We're not dealing here with, judging by substantial evidence.
Right.
What the answer is. We're judging this by clear and convincing evidence. So
right.
If there is some reasonable residual doubt,
then that ought to be in my favor.
That tilts in your favor.
Absolutely. It should, Your Honor. And what happened?
The reason why I raised it is you said, well, Kissinger shows exactly the same thing.
Right.
And I would think your argument would be, if it shows exactly the same thing, then there's massive clear error on the accumulation issue. But you don't have to show.
Right.
That's
correct, Your Honor. I'd say with respect to the three elements, that is, you have a retractable screen with an elongated bar that travels and tracks between weather stripping. The reason why the court was clear or committed clear error is because, again, the expert said, well, it's commercial. That's one reason. The other thing is, well, I'm not sure whether Kissinger has weather stripping, because in order to be weather stripping, the brushes have to be against the screen. And his testimony was all over the map as to what was or wasn't weather stripping. But here's the important thing about Kissinger. Kissinger not only shows you what the invention was and shows you the brushes, but Kissinger also describes in words exactly what those brushes do. And the words are found in column 4, lines 1-9, where Kissinger says, look, the edges of the screen panel are dressed on both sides in order for the smooth and burrless edges to engage the opposing brushes, and that results in an insect-impeding structure. In another part of the patent...
Which is close enough to weather stripping for a military.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, time is short.
Right.
What's wrong with the German patent?
The German patent...
For non-accumulation.
Okay, well, first, let's understand how German came up. German came up in the
parenthetical.
It was the parenthetical, see also. And that equated it
or
to...
Or your adversary in a bold parenthetical.
Right.
Talk to them or something.
Right, and so it, the way that it came up wouldn't tip anyone to even look at it, because it suggested that the German patent was equivalent of Kemp, that it showed the very thing Kemp did, that is, an elongated bar that traveled in the tracks. But again, with respect to German, Your Honor, first, there was no translation of German other than the abstract. So all we had to go by were the drawings. And the expert said there wasn't any question in his mind that...
Upon whom does the burden fall to become or not become responsible for the contents of a German language patent?
If their burden is to show that it was not cumulative, the burden's on them.
I mean, so the fact that they didn't translate the patent, for all I know, the German patent has got a lot of stuff in it that shows without question that it's not cumulative.
Your Honor, I don't think there's any argument about whether the German patent shows that it has brushes that are in contact with the screen. And so that's really not an issue here. The issue is whether German was cumulative to the Kissinger patent. And again, the Kissinger patent showed that these brushes were in contact with the screen, and it describes that functionality again. So there's not any question at all about it.
Well, assume for purposes of argument, you convinced the court that it was clear error for the district court to treat these three references as material, whether highly or not, because they're all cumulative. What's that get you?
Here's where it gets me.
Let's talk about the office.
Okay, let's talk about the office action. First, we have to understand, what did the panel know about the office actions in the other case? The panel knew, as a part of the request for reexamination, that there had been a first office action, that there was a co-pending case, that
the
claims...
Well, lay the facts out quite clearly. It wasn't your client that told the re-exam panel initially about Examiner Johnson's first rejection.
That's correct.
It was the uranium that told them.
That's
you
correct.
Get a little credit for reminding the re-exam panel that you did that, okay?
Yes.
And that initial rejection, as I recall, was essentially over Johnson.
Yes, under 102 and 103.
The examiner Johnson, in the first office action, the continuation said, you're out of here on Johnson, right?
Yes, you're right.
And so the main weapon against your patent in the re-exam cited by your adversary was Johnson. It hadn't been, they hadn't been in front of the original panel that granted your patent. So you get two more rejections by the continuation panel over Johnson plus, right?
Correct.
And so that's telling you that this continuation examiner Johnson can't get Johnson out of his crop. It's stuck there.
Okay.
And your main fight with the re-exam panel is to convince them that Johnson doesn't stand in the way. They don't seem to have much more art that they're worried about, right?
Correct.
So why isn't it material if you've got a continuation examiner who's got bitten his teeth and just keeps rejecting you over Johnson, for you to keep telling the re-exam panel that there's a fellow over in wing B of the PTO office that has got an entirely different view of the materiality of the Johnson reference than the re-exam panel has?
Because they already know it. What, I'm going to remind them again that they know it. By the way, he's done it again. He's looking at Johnson. They already know that he regarded the claims as anticipated.
For all they know, you convinced the continuation examiner, just like you convinced the re-exam panel, that Johnson didn't stand in your way.
Well, no, Your Honor, by the time they made the determination to allow the claims, what they thought about 039 is that the claims were rejected under Johnson. They didn't know that the claims were allowed. They thought the claims were rejected under Johnson, under 102 and 103. And that wouldn't have changed had these other office actions been brought to their attention. Nothing would have changed. It still would have been that same fact.
Well, maybe not. But the point is, isn't it, that the reasoning of the examiner Johnson in the third office action was not shared with the panel. The panel was aware of the existence of the 039 application,
correct.
Certainly aware of the prior art, but wasn't made aware of the fact that examiner Johnson was still having difficulties and the reasoning that supported his problems.
To the extent that he had any that differed from the other, Your Honor, but the fundamental fact remains that when they allowed the claims, they were under the impression that the 039 examiner was still rejecting the claims under 102 and 103 based primarily on Johnson.
Is that because of the 04 rejection that you first drew? Is that because of the first office action?
That's because of the first office action.
You're saying because of the first office action, the re-examining panel was necessarily under the understanding, if you will, that Johnson was rejecting, was the basis for rejection.
Yes, in the 039 continuation. Absolutely, Your Honor. That's correct.
But they didn't know whether the examiner, Johnson, was persisting in his rejection or whether he had given up on his rejection and was persuaded otherwise. Wouldn't it have been at least of interest to the panel to know where examiner Johnson stood?
Your Honor, what they knew about where he stood was that he had rejected the claims, and what he said later on didn't change it. You're quite correct. They didn't know that he had said it four times. But what they did know is that he had said it. And I don't think that makes...
They also didn't know that the continuation panel had made the rejection continuing over Johnson plus some more art.
Right, and all of that art, by the way, was before the patent office. All of the critical art.
I understand the art was before, assuming we wipe out the three pieces we wiped out.
Correct.
That we might wipe out. But the point is that the re-exam panel didn't know that those other pieces of art were being viewed differently by the continuation panel than they were going to be viewed by themselves. The continuation examiner was saying, you're still hung on Johnson, but not only are you hung on Johnson, but I'm accumulating some more art that's problematic.
Right.
And they were telling you that, telling your client.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Now, that additional information that the continuation examiner Johnson had more arrows in his quiver
right.
for shooting at you than just Johnson, those arrows were known to that they were there, but they weren't known to the re-exam panel that a fellow examiner was using them against you.
That's correct, Your Honor. So that part of it is correct.
So let me ask you this.
That's part of the reason why, as I think Judge Lynn suggested, that the law seems to be, at least at this stage in the game, where you have co-pending applications of one sort or another, re-exam or just a whole series of continuations and whatnot, the law said, be a straight shooter. Be a straight shooter. And just make certain that the fellow up on the 8th floor knows what's going on down on the 7th floor.
Right. It's hard to argue against that
as a legitimate policy, isn't it?
It couldn't
have been any greater burden on your client to alert the re-exam panel to the subsequent two office actions because you were sending a modified IDS, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You could have added one more line to the IDS saying, and oh, by the way, we got rejected again, not only just on Johnson, but on Johnson Plus.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, Dustin, let me ask you one question, sort of wrap up your time. Because of the questions you've had, you used up your rebuttal, and you're beyond your rebuttal, but we'll give you your full rebuttal.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, I know you want us to hold that there was no materiality because there was no materiality with respect to the office actions and the three prior art pieces that we discussed earlier. And that would obviously result in reversal if we came to that conclusion. Except, though, the possibility, what would be the correct result if we were to say, well, the office actions, the district court did not err in finding the office actions material.
Okay.
No question about it. However, we do think there was a lack of clear and convincing evidence with respect to the three pieces that we discussed earlier, preferred, genius, and the German patent. And again, I'm just speaking hypothetically for myself here. What would be the correct result if we came to that conclusion?
Well, since it...
What would we have to do with... What should we do with the case at that point?
I think in that instance, Your Honor, you'd probably have to send it back down because then he would have to weigh everything based on only the two office actions and not those other
references. The judge would have to look at intent based on the two office actions and then, depending on what he determined then, possibly have a balancing game.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can I just make a point? I know we're running over time, but I think this is important because it's an important issue. And what I want to say against you on your direct argument, so your adversary will have a chance to rebut, which I think is fair to them. Subsequent to the entry of the judgment in this case, this court has decided to celebrate the Star Scientific case, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
I am, Your Honor.
And in Star Scientific, we went to some trouble to point out that when you're trying to dial in the meter on the intent leg of an equitable conduct, if you're going to draw an inference of improper intent, it has to be the single most reasonable inference able to be drawn from the evidence. I believe that's the first time we've said that in those words. I would think that you would be arguing that you're entitled to have the intent in your case that would be drawn under Judge Schall's hypothetical just from the absence of the two office actions they reported.
Yes, sir.
You're entitled to have that conduct viewed through what I would call the star scientific lens.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And then I think you would also argue, I'm just saying this because I want your adversary to have an opportunity to rebut, I think you also are mounting the argument that the trial judge unfairly taxed you on the intent prong with the wrong kind of intent because you made a disclosure to the continuation panel of your victory at the re-exam but didn't do the reverse, and your argument is you have a legitimate reason, i.e. the double patenting issue, for having made that one-way disclosure.
Correct.
And you would feel that that point should be raised for the district court in terms of the balance.
Yes,
you also argue at some length that you were robbed by the district court of the good faith inferences that you were not allowed to have drawn.
From the Akron Palmer case. Correct, Your Honor.
Just one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just one question. That, in terms of Star Scientific and the conclusion that to find a threshold level of intent there and to infer intent, that inference must be not only a reasonable inference, but the most reasonable inference to be drawn.
Right.
Now, with respect to the references, you could say, well, all right, there might be other reasons why they might not have been disclosed. Maybe they're cumulative, or maybe the prosecuting attorney overlooked them. Simple negligence. And any number of different reasons. So it might be hard to contend that a intent should be inferred simply by the failure to disclose.
Right.
With respect to the office actions, I can't say that they were cumulative of anything. That really doesn't directly apply. It's a different twist on that.
Yeah, I'd have to disagree with you, Your Honor, on that point.
And in terms of, well, you know, we just overlooked it. It's hard to say he might have overlooked it when he cited the references to the examiner, just didn't cite the office actions
right.
to the examiner. What reasonable inference could be drawn other than the intent to deceive?
Because the fundamental information gleaned from all of the office actions was before the patent office, ever before the panel, and these nuances that might have appeared in the two office actions that were omitted wouldn't have changed anything. They wouldn't have been important to an examiner. And I don't believe that given all that information, you can say then, oh, now, the single most reasonable inference that we could make is they were trying to deceive the patent office because they didn't submit these last two items. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Yes.
We'll restore your full 3 minutes of rebuttal, and we'll hear from Luminart. Mr. Morgan, before you start, I want to do a housekeeping matter here. See, Mr. De La Garza used his rebuttal time, and we're going to restore that. Plus, he went over, I'm going to call it 6 minutes. It was 5 minutes and 45 seconds. We'll call it 6 minutes. So, he is going to have 9 extra minutes to his time. Okay. So, we're going to restore his rebuttal. In addition to that, he used 6 extra time because of all the questions. So, to make even it out, we'll give you an additional 9 minutes to your 15. I think that hopefully will work it out. So you'll have 24 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If you need it.
I'm not sure I will need it.
Just to make sure everyone gets the same amount of time.
I'm not sure whether the record reflects that. I'm Al Kowalczyk in reference to Mr. Morgan.
I apologize. You know, don't start.
Sorry.
I apologize, Mr. Walter. I was looking at the case above that, and thank you for correcting me. It's always disconcerting to be misaddressed, and I apologize.
Oh, no problem.
But anyway, just one other thing for you. So you want 2 minutes for your rebuttal, I guess.
At this point, that's correct. If I need it.
Okay, go ahead.
If it pleases the court, district court properly found inequitable conduct in this case, and I believe you're going to be asking questions about the materiality and the cumulative nature of some of these withheld items, but one thing I would like to have as an overview of that is that Larson's patent in this case involved nothing more than installing a commercially available retractable screen into a door. And they withheld that information from the re-examination panel. The retractable screen literature from Genius, was Larson's own supplier's retractable screen system. The German patent that came through the continuation process was a retractable screen patent that was also withheld. The retractable screen literature, key, the components that you mentioned in addressing Mr. De La Garza, the strip traveling in the channels between the weather strip.
Kissinger is not retractable?
Kissinger is retractable, and if you would like that.
Well, then, so what's the beef?
Kissinger did not show weather stripping in those channels, and it.
That's the question. I mean, instead of standing up here and trying to tell me, oh my God, you know, it didn't disclose and retract the screen, and you just now admitted they did, tell us why there is clear and convincing evidence, if you will, that Kissinger doesn't disclose weather stripping.
Because what was disclosed.
Why don't you talk about the lines in the Kissinger patent that Mr. Lingard has talked to us about?
Very good. You will see in the lines of column 4 of Kissinger. It was column 4, and I believe it
says a joint appendix.
It is A245 is the relevant page that I believe Judge Clevenger is directing my attention to.
245?
Yes, that's
249, page 249, column 4, where it talks about the brushes.
Line number?
I think you can start at line 1 through line 9 or 10 is the entire discussion of the feature. And in this discussion, you have to put it into the context of the invention that Kissinger is describing. And that is, you're looking at a simple pull screen. Yes, the pull screen retracts, it can be extended, but the pull screen has as a feature rubber bumpers 31 and 30, which you see in figure 5 of the patent at page A247. And those rubber bumpers hold the pull bar of the screen in place. This is a door that you pull across an opening and it just stays wherever you engage it. The insect impedance.
Are you telling me that weather stripping can't be composed of rubber?
That is.
If you do, then all the windows I have in my house that are weather stripping rubber got the wrong thing.
Your Honor, that's not the weather stripping that's being referred to in this patent. The weather stripping being referred to is items 35 and 36, these brushes. And those brushes, when you look at this invention that's described in Kissinger, those brushes are not shown to be engaging or retaining the screen edges. The invention that Larson...
Which is that one with drawings?
Yeah, that would be looking at figures 5 and 7 on A247, and these, I believe, were put into Larson's brief. Okay. When you look at figure 7, figure 5, with these bumpers that hold the pull bar in place, those bumpers holding the pull bar, behind that is the screen. The screen's behind the pull bar, and that screen has a dimension far less than the pull bar. It's much thinner.
What are the brushes? Are 36 the brushes?
Right, 35, 36 are the brushes. And you'll see that those are recessed in the channel. And the purpose of them being recessed is that they serve to impede insects in the track. They are not there for the purpose of restraining the screen, the edges of the screen, in place.
Well, it's a good amount of skill and the art to understand that it's sufficient to keep an insect out. It's probably sufficient to keep a drop of water out.
It's not the drop of water, Your Honor. It's whether these brushes serve to retain the screen edges.
Remember the old roll-down windows in your car? And what it had were brushes, right?
Correct. These brushes are...
They were weather-stripping.
Yes, and those brushes that you just described, Your Honor, are engaging the window. When you roll it down, they're engaging the window. This is the level of fact-finding that Judge Pearsall engaged
in. The burden was on your client to prove by clear and convincing evidence, right, that Kissinger was non-human.
Fully met, Your Honor, in the evidence, because Dr. Hall testified specifically that the genius literature, the brushes, or the pile, it was brush pile there showing, that did precisely what you were talking about, which is when you hold it in place, it will contact what you're retracting and extending continuously. These brushes don't touch the screen except inadvertently when they're fluttering or gapping. That is not screen retention.
Why do you say that it does not touch the screen? Doesn't it say on column 4, line 3, the burless edges to engage the opposed brushes?
And then it goes on, Judge Lynn, to talk about to resist gapping or fluttering. It's not talking about use of this recessed bristles for purposes of when you are extending and retracting the screen.
Where does it say that brushes are recessed?
The picture, when you look at figures 5 and 7 together, that's precisely what it shows in those brushes.
When you're trying to decide, Mr. Palachuk, if a particular reference is going to be cumulative or non-cumulative, can't we also say, well, what would one of ordinary skill in the art understand from this disclosure, say, here in column 4? And wouldn't one of ordinary skill in the art understand that brushes can also be used for weather stripping?
In light, correct, but the evidence at trial by Dr. Hall was that was not the purpose that they were being shown in Kissinger. That was precisely what the purpose was in the genius literature, which just so happened to be the retractable screen system that Larson was putting into their own product, a more material reference. You could not have the genius because it's what Larson put into their patented product. That level of distinction.
Are genius and the preferred, which I'll call the commercial part, are they entitled to more weight in a materiality setting because they are commercial art as opposed to a picture of a book?
Not solely on that basis, Your Honor.
If a district court judge said, I'm finding this particular piece of art material because it's commercial art as opposed to technical art, that would be error.
I believe that would be, because that's not what Judge Pearsall did. He found specifically that there were distinctions based on the evidence at trial between Kissinger and genius. Genius being the retractable screen that you just pull off the shelf and implement in a door. When you look at materiality, would an examiner find it to be important to the examination? The fact that you've got extensive literature showing brush piles, strips, that was clearly evidence that genius...
I don't understand your adversary to be arguing that the three art references are things that an examiner would have found uninteresting or not. I think he's got his eggs in the accumulation basket.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that the cumulative art basket must look at the nature and the full content of what you're comparing. So when you compare genius as the screen that you pull off the shelf, put in the door, compared to a patent that respectfully, it's being interpreted by Mr. Della Garza. There was an opinion given to you of what this shows. The words aren't there. Judge Pearsall judged the evidence. He judged the cross-examination of Dr. Hall when it was repeatedly attempted to get Dr. Hall to admit it was weather stripping and that it was weather stripping for the purpose of retaining the screen edges in operation. And that was a very important feature. And to the extent genius didn't show it, when the German reference came forward, as the brief shows you in the pictures of the German reference, there can be no question that that German reference specifically addressed making sure you had some tight contact in the screen channel between brushes and the edges of the screen, so as you're using this retractable screen going up and down regularly, the screen isn't going to come out of the track.
Where is that the German, which picture are you referring to in connection with the German reference? I was looking at it yesterday, and I can't find it. On the German patent is at 2040. The drawings of the German patent started in 2050. Volume 2 of the Joint Appendix. And I just, because you were focusing on what it showed, I was wondering what drawing in particular.
Okay. Well, it does show up at page 12 of the red brief is where the joke figures are actually reproduced from the appendix. Figures 3 and 4, which show the interaction of the channel brushes with the screen, specifically in figure 4. And so the feature of the importance of the screen retention was, to the extent anybody could argue with genius, somehow the brush pile not being of a higher caliber of disclosure than the Kissinger patent, the German patent closed the deal. And that was withheld. And in the argument, there was some discussion about the office actions being withheld and the consequence of that. What was not, I call it the second chain of non-disclosure. You had the patent office non-disclosures, you had the commercial literature non-disclosures. In the patent office non-disclosures, not only did you have the office actions continually saying, hey look, these substantially similar claims, we're not buying the argument, you know, they're rejected. The second office action, the June 06 office action, included this German patent being given to Larsen, and not only was the office action not provided.
This was the third office action?
Correct. The office action included a copy of this German reference, and it wasn't passed on to the re-examination
panel. This is where we have the parenthetical right after Kissinger, correct?
Correct.
And if you had your way, you would take back and hold it down in your brief, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I apologize. Emphasis added should have appeared in the quote. But the literature, and if I could just get back to preferred for a second, because we haven't talked about preferred in the camp. And the idea of commercial literature, it's what is in the commercial literature, not just that it's commercial literature that's important. The preferred engineering literature was the very screen system that was being implemented by Luminar, the accused infringer, in their product. It was implementation literature, again, showing how easy it is to just
it
take...
It was so material and patentability that your client did not disclose it to the re-exam.
Your Honor, if I could explain that. The re-exam was brought on the basis of the Johnson patent coming up for the first time.
The purpose of the re-exam proceeding was to destroy the patent so that you could go back to the district court to stay the action until they dismissed the complaint. Right?
We were fully...
It was war.
We were fully comfortable at Johnson.
Ordinarily, in war, you launch every missile you have, including the Dutch.
We thought
you did not find it necessary to tell the re-exam panel about this about the preferred art.
At the time. We believed that the Johnson patent being used to anticipate the claims in the continuation case and being dead on, in our view, with the claims of the patent suit.
Johnson the only art you cited in the re-exam?
The only other art used, Your Honor, was underlying secondary art from the original patent application. Preferred did not become highly material until Larsen started to argue with the re-exam board that, oh, the distance the strip is not in the channel is a grounds to distinguish the invention. At that point, the art of Altmedia Industries strips that went into the channel like Preferred became highly material. At that point in the process, we were well into the ex parte prosecution of this by Larsen, who had the obligations relative to the preferred information. On the front end, it wasn't viewed as the basis. It wasn't put in the arsenal. Later, it became important. Secondarily, not only was it the dead-on commercial literature type of materiality, when you look at Kemp itself, Judge Pearsall made his evaluations. Kemp is a 1938 patent on a screen system. And if you look at page 10 in the brief, where we recreated the page from the preferred engineering brochure.
What page?
Page 10, and if you prefer, in the appendix, it appeared at A2293. That's a blow-up picture of that preferred screen system.
2293?
Correct, Judge. This preferred engineering literature, you see, has guides for the screen down at the top and the bottom. And you'll see they're identified as profile with groove to accept glide. Profile. When you look at that profile, what you see is a very constricted profile for the screen to travel in the constriction at the top of the profile. Kemp was just an open channeled groove that the screen went up and down. The preferred
this thing here, is this a screen or it looks odd?
Yeah, this is what they call a screen module. If you orientate the page the long way, you'll see that what's called the profile of the grooves would be your side tracks.
Oh, and this picture is broken apart. You have to slam it all together to see the screen, right?
Correct.
But it's a window screen.
Correct. It's the window screen that Illuminar and the testimony of trial indicated was simply put into the product that was accused of infringing. Prior art product put into the accused infringing device. That information known to Larson and never turned into the patent office. This was not Kemp. This was the literature of what was put in the accused product. It was prior art. It was highly material to, you know, the point of being an obvious invention to just stick the screen into a door. So Kemp was not, this literature was not cumulative to Kemp. So I think I've addressed the German reference, Kemp and Kissinger and Genius as to the evidence in the record. Judge Pearson.
Well, your strongest argument is that the standard of review here is one of us finding clear error. Right?
I believe that's correct, and I also believe that the fact that there was no evidence offered in the way of testimony in this case is quite dramatic. I think on appeal, you see the arguments that were offered in argument by Larson's counsel at trial, and they were found not to be credible in view of the evidence.
Yes, in regard to you mentioned the evidence that was put in. In a situation like this, the alleged infringer who was asserting inequitable conduct has to establish its case by clear and convincing evidence on the issues of materiality and intent. Now, assume we're in a situation like we are here, where cumulativeness is an issue. Does the alleged infringer have to come in and put in all of the evidence of prior art and make an affirmative case as to why there is non-cumulativeness, or once the alleged infringer comes in, even though the burden remains on it, does the patentee have to come forward with evidence showing cumulativeness? Did I say it clearly?
I understand, Judge Shaw. I believe that there is some burden once you've gone forward showing the evidence of materiality. The issue of cumulativeness does require some evidence from the patentee to rebut that, because as I looked at the case law on cumulative,
that's cumulative is not material. So isn't it the accused's burden to establish materiality, and doesn't that carry with it the obligation to show that it's not cumulative?
I believe that's true, and it was done here. There was an obligation to address cumulativeness after putting forth the clear and convincing evidence that it was material. The basis for materiality were provided. The testimony at trial by Dr. Hall also addressed why he didn't believe it was cumulative of the references that were before the court. So I believe...
Your adversary in the brief on page 55 alleged that you, the client, were required to demonstrate by a clear and convincing evidence that the omitted information was not cumulative. And I didn't understand you to contradict that in the brief. You understood that was your burden?
Correct. But the standard of cumulative...
Right, so whether the patentee does or does not have an obligation to come forward once you have put non-cumulation in issue doesn't affect your burden of proof.
No, our burden of proof is the same, and I think it's quite clear how you address them.
It matters in a way, because you a minute ago said, well, the patentee here didn't say anything. They had legal, you know, lawyer argument. But if there was no burden on the patentee to, a burden of coming forward once an issue is raised, because the entire obligation to prove non-cumulation rests with you, then the patentee would just sit there and zip his lip if he wanted to, and it would not cost him anything.
I am not sure, as Judge Shaw's question, that it's clear the burden of clear convincing evidence attaches to showing materiality art. I also believe there is a responsibility in showing that you establish it's not cumulative of other information that's being considered.
Why make the patentee have to say anything with regard to the issue of cumulation and non-cumulation? What's wrong with putting the entire burden on the attacker?
I believe that's...
You have to prove a negative, but there's no problem. You know what the art is.
I think the problem with it, Your Honor, is that when you get to a situation like this, the cumulativeness argument allows attorneys to come forward with constructions, interpretations, opinions that are not subject to challenge by cross-examination. You can make up whatever you want an argument about what a reference shows.
But you're not talking about burden of proof. You're really talking about the weakness of the other side's case.
Correct, and I think the standard had been met in this case.
Well, let me ask you, because your 24 minutes is all gone except for about a minute and 50 seconds. I asked a hypothetical question to your opposing counsel, Mr. Bill Garza, about, assume for the moment we agreed that the office actions that weren't disclosed were material, but that we disagreed and felt that a clear and convincing case had not been made out with respect to the three references. And he said that at that point, the case would have to, if that result were reached, the case would have to go back for a determination of intent in that light. And then if there was a finding of the requisite intent, the balancing. Do you agree or disagree with what he said in response to that hypothetical?
I disagree, Your Honor. I believe that under cases such as the Monsanto case, I believe if you have one on all fours case of inequitable conduct for highly material information withheld with evidence of intent supporting it, I believe that that is adequate to affirm the district court's determination.
Even though it did seem here that the district court was understandably impressed by what it viewed as the multitude of undisclosed items, the office actions and the three pieces of prior art that we've been discussing.
But I think the court also addressed each one of those items independently on materiality and addressed the intent.
But assume the purpose of argument that the only thing the judge had to work with were the two office actions. That was Judge Shaw's hypothetical. What's your strongest case to say that we can affirm the district court's judgment on the intent and balancing?
I think it would be the Monsanto case. And if I could just add, separating the office actions from the German reference in this case is not, doesn't work.
What do you do with the Star Scientific? We've had what might be viewed in a way as a, maybe not a sea change, but we've got a major wave that has been created in deciding intent. Recent case law, this court has shown a certain amount of nervousness by the court towards the issue of intent being perhaps in some cases too easily found. Why isn't the district court entitled to review the intent based on the two office actions through the lens of Star Scientific.
Because, Your Honor, I think in Star Scientific, as I read it, it talks about that the only reasonable interpretation from the evidence is that there was an intent to deceive. And here, there was numerous evidence. There was evidence on each one of these five items.
The hypothetical has to do with three of the items being removed from consideration. So you've got two left. And with respect to the office action, your adversary is saying, well, the two, at the time that the re-exam patent was issued, as far as the re-exam panel knew, that good old Mr. Johnson was standing firm and had rejected. And the additional art, now that the three pieces would have been eliminated, the art that the examiner Johnson was using collaterally was known to the re-exam panel. And he's saying, in the light of that, then you can't say that the only most reasonable inference you can draw of failing to disclose the two office actions is evil intent.
I believe it is, Your Honor, from the evidence, the evidence of record. I think my reading of Star Scientific was that you have to be able to show this reasonable explanation in the evidence, and there was no evidence offered on this point. Once it was established, these items were withheld per DACO, and they were shown to be withheld, both office actions, over and over again. There was no evidence. The case law is also talking about, when is it that you need to come up with...
You said Mr. Patterson didn't come in to testify.
Nobody, not an inventor, not Mr. Patterson, nobody. And the law to me was quite clear that a plausible explanation has to be offered in the evidence once you've carried forth.
Well, just Judge Smith has a question.
Just one more. It seems to be Star Scientific. Made the point that there at least some threshold level of intent has to be established before there is any obligation to come forth with good faith evidence.
And the repeated withholding of office actions in this case by the person who's handling the re-exam and the continuation applications, I believe, meets that threshold of evidence just on the office actions. And I will try to continue to bring that German patent in, which was cited in the office action, to that same individual who made the decision, the selection, to not turn in the information that appears to be pertinent.
Right, but our case law that you're citing, there were instances in which one panel was kept completely in the dark about what the other panel did, right?
I believe that the...
You remember Akron Polymer, it wasn't a question of keeping them completely in the dark, it was just sort of like something in the dark. And in Akron Polymer, we said, well, you've got to draw some beneficial inference, or at least having tried, not having kept the second panel entirely in the dark.
When you're making selective decisions of what to keep the panel in the dark on and what not to keep the panel in the dark on, I think you go...
That's part of the fine line of what happens when you go from saying, well, this is not an instance in which the patentee drew a Chinese wall between the two proceedings. It did everything he could to make certain that one panel didn't even know the other one existed. Right? That did come, I think. So
and
here, there's a certain amount of slipping back and forth between the two panels that's actually being encouraged by the patentee.
And I think that, in view of McKesson, I believe that slippage is actually part of the evidence of the intent. The selection of certain information and then withholding the highly material points of view to package it so that it appears that there are not problems and that you are doing things in good faith is actually the evidence of the intent.
You would grant at least that your case is different if the three pieces of actual art were excluded. If they had been killed.
Would our case be
your
different?
Case is different.
Yes, absolutely.
Mr. Kowalczyk, thank you. I'm looking at this, you've had almost the amount of time we give for an in-bank argument. But I think we'll have to bring it to an end. Mr. John Garza, you will have, we'll give you 4 minutes of
Very well, Your Honor, but I thought I was going to respond to their cross-appeal, and they haven't even addressed that.
All right.
On the exceptionality issue, and with the court's permission, should they go first on that since they have the burden?
They haven't brought it up.
Well, brief.
So we'll give you 4 minutes if you need it. And you'll have had maybe a minute less than Mr. Kowalczyk, but within the pale of reasonableness.
Your Honor, I don't believe I'll need 4 minutes, but
okay.
The question...
Don't think you don't want to be arguing that you haven't had a good hearing.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and Your Honors, and we appreciate it. Thank you very much. Very good questions. But let me say that fundamentally, should you decide, and theoretically, that the three references are gone and we're only looking at the office actions, then I think that must go back down to the judge. He's got to look at it because no longer one of the office actions that had the German. The German's not material, then that makes that office action less material. And that's going to have to be considered, that's going to have to be weighed. And I think the case will also have to be weighed based on the language in Stark, the holding in Stark. And so if you do decide that, then it has to go back down there. So that's all I have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenhauser. Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Kowalczyk. The case is submitted.